Okay, well, let's move on to Kripke's own solution to the skeptical paradox. He distinguishes between what he calls a straight solution and a skeptical solution. A straight solution is a solution to a problem which meets it head on. So in this case, which would try to produce a meaning-constituting fact to answer the skeptic. Remember, the skeptic's challenge was, what fact can you point to justify your applying the plus sign in a certain way now, and what fact can you point to constitute your meaning a certain particular thing by that sign, namely the addition function as opposed to the quaddition function. And remember that for the purposes of setting up the puzzle, we have to assume we know what we're talking about, so we have to assume that we know how to distinguish between the addition function and the quaddition function. So the skeptic is asking for some fact that both constitutes my meaning one thing rather than another by a particular sign, and justifies my applying the sign in a particular way here and now. And these two facts are two sides of the same coin, in effect. If there is such a constituting fact, then I can simply appeal to that in justification. So a straight solution would be one which met the skeptic's challenge head-on and attempted to find such a fact and produce it. That's a straight solution. A skeptical solution, by contrast, is a solution which accommodates the skepticism, basically accepts the skeptical paradox, but argues that it's not as disruptive, it's not as damaging as it appears. We can live with it. So Kripke offers a skeptical solution, and this involves his saying that ascriptions of meaning are not fact-stating and do not have truth conditions. So he takes this to be an implication of the skeptical paradox. If one accepts its terms, one is committed to saying, well, meaning is not a factual matter. So statements of meaning are not factual, they do not have truth conditions. Rather, says Kripke, they have assertability conditions. They have conditions under which it's okay to assert that you mean or that somebody else means such and such. These claims are not up for assessment as true or false, but they're supposedly up for assessment as being assertable or not. So you're allowed to make certain claims, according to this line, even though the claims are not true or false. And in the present case, the claim that I mean addition by the plus sign rather than quaddition, say, that will be assertable, according to the solution that Kripke favours, just if my practice in using that sign agrees with the rest of the community's practice in using it. So the community, as it were, forms a kind of club with club rules. And these are basically rules about how to speak the language. And so one of the rules will involve the word plus and the cross sign that we use for that function. And the club will have its rules about how one should use those signs. And members of the club have got to follow those rules. And then the idea is that the community will be prepared to adopt me as a member, as a club member, and accept my rule-following practice for the plus sign, just if my responses to relevant questions agree with theirs. So that relevant questions being questions of the form, what is M plus N? And if we find that my responses to questions of that form, what is 3 plus 6, what is 75 plus 213, if my responses agree with theirs, then they will, as it were, adopt me as a club member and say, yes, I know what addition is, I grasp that function, I understand the plus sign. But a statement such as Gaskin means addition by that cross sign is not to be regarded as fact-stating, according to this sceptical solution. It's not to be regarded as fact stating. It's not to be regarded as having truth conditions. It's to be interpreted as a gesture of acceptance, really, a mark of the community's willingness to treat me as a member of the linguistic club. So the statement isn't true or false. It's a kind of welcoming gesture, if you like. It's got another function than fact stating. I'm allowed into the club, and that means that I'm expected to manipulate the sign plus in the same way as the other club members, and they've admitted me because I'm already doing that. So that's Kripke's skeptical solution in outline. And I think it's probably fair to say that most critics have responded rather negatively to the skeptical solution. I mean, it's a bit like the situation that you got back in the 17th century with Descartes. Descartes wrote his Meditations and his Discourse, and he set up an epistemological problem: how can I know anything? And he basically followed a skeptical line. He followed the skeptic down a particular path to the apparent conclusion that he didn't know anything. He then decided, oh, well, there are some things that I know. I know things about myself, about my inner experience. But he then had the problem of getting back from there to ordinary knowledge about things in the world. They didn't seem to be guaranteed at all by the cogito on which he was relying to give his knowledge a foundation. And as I'm sure you know, he appealed to God in order to bridge that gap. And in the reception of his work, people were very impressed by the problem, but they weren't so keen on the solution. They thought it was rather a poor solution. And I think something similar has gone on with Kripke. People have been impressed by the skeptical paradox, but they haven't been so impressed by Kripke's own solution to it. They've thought that other solutions should be offered. And we'll come back to that a bit later. Let's talk first about Kripke's own solution and what objections people have raised to it. So one objection that's been raised, and this might look like a bit of a terminological dispute of not much importance, but actually I think it is quite important. One objection has been raised to the question, well, is it actually a skeptical solution? Is that the right label for it? Or is it really a straight solution in disguise? And the reason why you might think it was really a straight solution is that it does seem to offer a factual, truth-conditional account of what meaning ascriptions consist in. So in other words, when you ascribe understanding to somebody, you say, well, so-and-so understands that plus sign, and that, remember, according to Kripke's account, is a sort of gesture of acceptance. You're accepting that person into the linguistic club. And the statement that so-and-so does mean addition by the plus sign, which is this gesture of acceptance, that's not supposed to have truth conditions. It's not supposed to be fact-stating. Although it looks as though it's a fact-stating kind of thing, it's really got another function. That's Kripke's idea. But the objection that's been made to him is, well, why say that? I mean, surely it is fact-stating. It's stating a fact, or a purported fact, about my, if I'm the rule follower in question, about my practice and whether it agrees with the rest of the communities. And it's saying, suppose I'm the person who's being admitted to the linguistic club, it's saying, well, my linguistic practice, at least as far as concerns this particular sign, the plus sign, agrees with that of the rest of the community. That's why they're admitting me to the club. And that seems a purely straightforwardly factual matter. Does my practice agree with theirs or not? We're all faced with questions of the form, what is M plus N? And the rest of the community notice that my responses agree with theirs. That's why they admit me to the club as somebody who grasps the rule of addition. Well, why isn't that a straightforwardly factual matter? The fact in question being not quite the one that we started with, namely the fact that you really do grasp that rule. Rather, the fact in question is the fact that my practice agrees with that of the rest of the community. The idea is that in saying that my practice agrees with that of the rest of the community, we are stating a fact, or purporting to state a fact. It's factual discourse. We're aiming to say something about the world. We're aiming to say something true about the world, namely that my practice agrees with that of the rest of the community. And that looks like an ordinary statement that can be true or false, that is factual, that has truth conditions. And so it seems as though that gives you a response to the skeptic, a straight response. When the skeptic says, look, what fact can you point to justify your confidence that this is the right answer to this particular sum, and that this is what you always meant by that sign of addition, you meant this particular function, you can point indeed to a fact that justifies your confidence and that constitutes your having meant that particular rule, namely the fact that your responses agree with the rest of the community's responses to the same question. That's what justifies you in thinking that you really are following that particular rule and not some deviant quaddition-like rule. So it looks as though Kripke is really giving a straight solution in disguise. He really is offering a fact to the skeptic that one can appeal to in justification of one's confidence to be latching on to one particular rule and not another one, to be understanding a sign in one particular way and not in another way. And this fact that one can appeal to constitutes, namely that one's practice agrees with that of the community, that constitutes my having the right to say, well, I really do grasp that rule. I really do understand the plus sign, and I understand it as addition and not as some deviant function, because my practice agrees with the community. You might say, well, that's what they call it. Whatever function it is, it's the function they're computing. They call it addition. My practice agrees with theirs, so I'm computing addition as well. Well, to deal with this objection, Kripke would have to extend his non-factualism not merely to meaning ascriptions, but also to claims concerning the disagreement or agreement of an individual practice with the community's practice. That's to say, the objection to Kripke was, well, look, it's a factual matter, isn't it, Kripke, whether or not my practice agrees with the community's practice or not. Am I following the rule in the same way as they are? That's surely a factual matter. And if I say that I am, that's a statement that has truth conditions. It can be true or false. And your solution to the skeptical puzzle was to say, well, I count as understanding the plus sign if my practice accords with the way the rest of the community uses that sign. Then I count as a member of the club, and I count as grasping the rule associated with that particular sign. And the objection to Kripke was, well, it's a purely factual matter whether I do agree with the rest of the community in my practice or not. And I can appeal to that in justification of my claim to understand the plus sign and to understand it as meaning addition rather than quaddition. And if Kripke is to resist that straight solution, as it will, that straight twist to his own solution of the skeptical paradox, then he would have to say, well, actually, questions about agreement or disagreement between your practice and the rest of the community's practice, that's actually not a factual matter. That again, and he would spin the same story again, he would say, whether or not your practice agrees, that's a matter of the community's say-so. If they admit you to the club on that basis, you know, for that particular sort of rule following, then you count, your practice counts as agreeing with theirs. But once again, I claim, says Kripke, that this is what he would have to say, that it's not a factual matter whether your practice agrees with the community's practice or not. In saying that it does, so the community might say, well, yeah, you're obviously doing the same as we're doing, so you count as a member of the club. But when the community says, you're obviously doing the same as we're doing, although that looks like a factual statement, which ought to be assessable as true or false from an objective perspective, in fact, Kripke would have to say that it isn't. It's another gesture of acceptance. It's something that may be assertable, but it's not true or false. I mean, this is starting to look pretty implausible, of course, but I think this is the way that Kripke would have to go. So in other words, I mean, what this means is that abandoning factualism about meaning ascriptions and taking the kind of line that Kripke does on how to construe meaning ascriptions, namely in terms of agreement or disagreement with the rest of the community, doing that would require, if it's not to collapse into a straight solution, would require Kripke to abandon factualism quite generally. So meaning and meaning ascriptions would be in the same boat as everything else. They would not be factual matters. So saying that somebody meant something by a certain sign, that would not be a factual kind of assertion. It would be a gesture of acceptance, say, or rejection, but some kind of pragmatic move like that. But then so would everything else be non-factual. So in the first instance, saying that somebody's practice agreed with yours or with the rest of the community's would also have to be a non-factual matter. And then it seems very hard to stop the rot, as it were, to stop the complete collapse of factualism, because, I mean, if that's a non-factual matter, and that's, you know, not as such a fact about, or a purported fact about meaning, whether somebody's practice agrees with is the same as the practice of the rest of the community, that looks like a common or garden fact, or purported fact. So that if that is not factual, it's very hard to see how anything else is going to be either. And what that means is that if, and we're still on this first objection to the sceptical solution, this is why I think it is quite a significant objection, not a merely terminological one. If the sceptical, the purported sceptical solution, brings a general non-factualism in its wake, so there are no facts about anything, in other words, then that is so extreme, so radical a doctrine, that in a sense, you know, it's like people say extremes meet in politics. If you go that far, then there's a question as to whether you really are actually really saying anything different from the position you started off objecting to. I mean, what's the difference between saying there are no facts about anything, just practices of agreement and disagreement, and the apparent factuality of these practices is itself constituted by agreement and disagreement, again construed in a non-factual way, and so on. What's the difference between saying that and saying that, oh yes, there is indeed such a thing as factuality, as we always thought, but it's constituted by communal decision, it's constituted by communal agreement as a matter of what the community says. So something counts as a fact if the community recognises it as a fact. But now if we go that way, and this is the second objection, we end up with a sort of communitarian position, as people call it, in which facts are settled by communal decision. But that seems implausible. Surely the community itself can go wrong. Now, you know, even on matters of meaning, you might think, well, yes, it's not a very radical thought to think that the whole community could go wrong on a scientific matter, say whether the sun goes around the earth or not. You know, whole communities have gone wrong, we think, on that question. So that's not so problematic, but wouldn't it be problematic to say that a whole community was wrong about what its words meant? That seems much more difficult, that idea. Surely there the community is the arbiter of meaning, one's inclined to say. But I don't think that that's right. I mean, I don't think that's straightforwardly correct, I should say. I think in the long run it's correct. If the community uses a word in a certain way, then over time that usage becomes correct, but it may not start out as correct. Okay. So you can imagine a situation in which the whole community is exposed to some drug, say, and everyone wakes up next morning saying, oh, 2 + 2 = 6. Now, if people go on saying that, then at a certain point, I think looking on from the outside, one might say, well, the words have changed their meaning. They no longer mean what they used to mean by all of these words. Although they're not aware of it themselves, they've actually changed the meaning of maybe the plus sign or one of the numerals. And so in due course, their usage will become correct again because of what the words now mean. Maybe the word two has come to mean three, in which case the sentence 2 + 2 = 6 will be correct, as they said. But initially, that hasn't happened yet. We're still working under the old contract, as it were. You remember the idea of meaning or understanding as entering into a contract. And if everyone wakes up tomorrow morning having been subjected, unbeknown to them, say, by some drug, or having, you know, aliens have hacked into all their brains, something like that, and start saying things like 2 + 2 = 6, initially they will be wrong. The whole community will be wrong, because initially the words will go on meaning what they meant before. And it's only once a new usage, a new practice has gradually become established, that that sentence will flip and become true because the words in it will have changed meaning. But initially, the words in that sentence will mean what they have always meant, or for a long time at any rate, in the English language, and that sentence will be false, even though everyone says it and believes it. So it's not simply the case that factuality on matters of meaning is a matter of communal decision. In the long run, yes, there is a sense in which meaning is use, as Wittgenstein said, and so the way a word gets used, certainly over time, that is its meaning, or that contains its meaning. And if we all start using the word two, say, T-W-O, as though it referred to the number three, then although initially there will be a hiccup, in due course, that is what the word two will come to mean. That will be the new usage. Okay, but initially it won't be that. Initially, as I said before, we're still under the old rules, the rules of the old contract. And so a lot of what we say using the word two will be false. Now, in effect, Kripke's skeptical solution, although he himself doesn't put it this way, but in effect, it applies the dispositional analysis at the level of the community. Remember that the dispositional attempt to solve, or the dispositionalist attempt to solve the skeptical puzzle, was to say, well, your understanding is a matter of what you're disposed to do. So if you are in fact disposed to apply the rule of addition when you use the cross sign, the plus symbol, as opposed to the rule of quaddition, then that's the rule you mean. If that's what you're disposed to do, if that's what you're wired up to do, as it were. And Kripke rejects that solution at the level of the individual, as we saw in the last lecture. But it seems as though he accepts it at the level of the community, because in effect he's saying the rule, the meaning associated with the plus sign, is constituted by what the community says, by the community say-so. If the community says this is the way to do it, this is the way to apply that symbol, then that's the last word on the matter. On his view, nobody can come along and contradict the community and say, no, you're misapplying this symbol. If that's what the community says, its word goes. And of course, what it says is a matter of what it's disposed to say. That's it. Community will be playing out its dispositions when it applies, when it makes use of and it manipulates the symbol for addition, the plus sign. And in effect, in objecting to his communitarian solution, I have simply been applying Kripke's own criticism of the dispositionalist account, which is that it makes no room for mistakes. Kripke says you have got to make room for mistakes at the level of the individual, But in effect, he's saying you don't have to make room for mistakes at the level of the community. The community can't make mistakes. Whatever it says goes. And that was the bit I was objecting to. I was saying, well, actually, although in the long run, as far as the meaning of a word is concerned, yes, what the community says goes in the sense that its usage establishes the meaning of the word. But in the short run, the community certainly can go wrong on the meaning of a word in the sense that it can misapply a word. It can break the contract that it itself has established. It can break its own rules, just as a club can break its own rules. And again, the parallel is illuminating. I mean, if a club has a bunch of rules and people suddenly start breaking one of the rules, and let's say they don't notice, so like the drug case I had before, but an outside observer watching their behaviour sees that the members of the club are, in fact, all of a sudden, breaking one of their own rules. Well, if they go on breaking that rule, then a point will come where we, as it were, stop describing it in that way. We will say, well, actually, they've now established a new rule. They're no longer constantly breaking the same old rule. A new practice has become established. A new rule has become established. That's the one they're conforming their behaviour to. But initially, we won't say that. Initially, looking on, we will say they are breaking their own rules. So Kripke is, I think, applying a dispositionalist analysis at the level of the community, even though he argued against it at the level of the individual. And I have, in effect, been recycling his objections to applying the dispositionalist account at the level of the individual. I've been recycling them in the case of the community. The community, I've been saying, is liable to make mistakes in following a rule. So in the case of linguistic meaning, it is able to use a word wrongly, at least in the short run. And of course, the other aspect of Kripke's argument against dispositionalism at the level of the individual applies too. That was the point about infinity, which is that the rule goes on applying itself to infinity, as it were. The rule of addition churns out sums for pairs of numbers into infinity, if you like. But an individual rule follower only has finite dispositions. And the same applies to the community, of course, and I mentioned that earlier at the same time in anticipation of this point, that the community as a whole has finite dispositions. The human race as a whole has finite dispositions. And that means that our dispositions to apply the rule of addition, to manipulate the plus sign, they will come apart eventually, no matter how good we are at adding. We won't be able to go through the infinity of sums that are out there. So our dispositions to apply the rule of addition will, at a certain point, flatline. They won't give any answer at all because we'll have died out as a species. But we don't take ourselves, because of that fact, we don't take ourselves to be, in fact, computing some deviant function, one which agrees with addition on small numbers, in fact on large finite numbers as well, on right up to some vast number it agrees with addition, up to the largest number that we will compute in the whole history of humankind. And then after that it diverges from addition, because whereas the addition function goes on churning out the sum of pairs of input numbers, these are, you know, these huge numbers now that are being inputted into the function. The addition function isn't bothered by the size of them. It happily churns out the answer because it's just a Platonic ideal object. Okay, but our disposition, once we get to a sufficiently large input, will simply give out, conk out, and we won't give any answer at all to questions of the form, what is m plus n, where m and n are sufficiently large. And that's, again, as I said at the earlier stage, there's a perfectly good mathematical function which mimics addition up to m and n for some very large m and n, but then gives no output thereafter, right? That's a perfectly good function. And that's the one that our dispositions are, in fact, computing. But we don't therefore say, of ourselves. Oh, we don't really grasp the rule of addition. We grasp another function, which is very like addition. And, you know, it's very like addition in the sense that it matches addition on all the numbers we're ever going to need to calculate with. But on some sufficiently large number, or sufficiently pair of sufficiently large numbers as input, it will then diverge from addition in the sense that it will then give no answer. And it's that deviant function that we really grasp. That's what we really actually mean by the plus sign. Right? And that's not what we say. But if we were being dispositionalist about our understanding as a community, that is what we should say, I think. So this is another problem for Kripke's account, given that he is applying the dispositionalist analysis at the level of the community. The community say-so goes, but the community doesn't have a disposition to compute the addition function, not that very function, because that very function is infinitistic, and the community doesn't have infinite dispositions. It has only finite dispositions. So the community has a disposition to compute a different function, one like Kripke's own quotient function, except that it flatlines at a much later stage, after some very large finite input. And so for practical purposes, it doesn't really matter that we're not adding, because we only need this function for relatively small finite numbers, and on those this deviant function agrees with the addition function. But the truth of the matter would be that we weren't really computing with the addition function. We were computing with this quotition function, that we weren't really grasping the rule of addition. So even, you know, so when you're being taught at school, and when I'm talking about addition now, I'm not really talking about that infinitistic function that we all think we're talking about, the one that goes on churning out the sum of two numbers for any inputs, no matter how large the numbers. No, I'm actually really talking about, because the word addition, the word plus, really means this deviant function, which at a certain point gives out, gives up, dies, as the human species will. Okay, so that seems to be the view that Kripke is committed to, and I suggest that his own objection, when that view was encountered at the level of the individual, I suggest that it occurs again at the level of the community. It seems, well, perhaps it's not absurd to say that we don't really grasp the addition function, but at any rate it seems wrong. Surely we do grasp it. Even though, in spite of the fact that our dispositions are finite, nevertheless, we want to allow, surely, that we hook onto, we grasp in thought, we make contact with this ideal object, this ideal infinitistic object, the rule of addition. Somehow we overstep ourselves, we get beyond ourselves, we have finite dispositions, but somehow we seem to grasp the idea of infinity. And this is one application, this is one way in which we do that grasping. We grasp a rule, we grasp the meaning of a sign, like the plus sign, which is infinitistic, and so which goes beyond, infinitely beyond, any dispositions that we ourselves have to compute, to manipulate that sign. So well beyond our practice, in other words. And that's quite an intriguing, quite an odd thought, that we set up this rule, and we set it up on the basis of our practice, right? And we start, you know, we started, and we still do most of the computations with the plus sign using quite small numbers. You know, it started off in computations like 3 plus 5. Now, we need it for larger numbers than that, but they're still, in cosmic terms, pretty small numbers that we're dealing with, right? And yet, our understanding outstrips, goes beyond our practice. I mean, there's a sort of sense of overkill here, if you like. We're grasping this Platonic ideal object, which goes well beyond the extent to which we will ever apply it or need it. And yet we're quite sure that it is that thing that we're grasping, that particular rule, and not some Kripke-style deviant function which mimics that rule on low numbers and then gives out after a certain point. We're absolutely certain that that's not the case. And the situation here is really parallel to the case of the individual. I mean, if you remember what I said there was, well, an individual counts as grasping a rule, as understanding a word, grasping the rule associated with that word. So long as that individual can, broadly speaking, get it right. So if we stick with the example of the plus sign, as long as you can do ordinary computations with that sign, you count as understanding it. Do ordinary computations correctly, I mean. You have finite dispositions. You also have dispositions to make mistakes under abnormal conditions, as we said, under conditions of great stress or where you're being asked to compute something very complicated. Under these conditions, you are bound to make a mistake. We all are. So our individual dispositions come apart from the rule. At fairly low finite numbers, in fact. And this was held, in the earlier discussion, this was held to be an objection to the dispositionalist account of individual understanding. Because if we followed the dispositionalist account, we'd have to say of any individual, of every individual, that individual didn't really grasp the rule of addition. And the idea was, in Kripke's earlier criticism of the dispositionalist account, that would be absurd. We do allow individuals to grasp the rule of addition, to understand the plus sign. Not, as I said before, if their behavior with it is radically deviant, you know, in situations where they're not under stress and where they're being given easy sums to compute. If there they make mistakes, then, of course, that person is not grasping the rule, has not understood the sign. Right? But so long as your practice with the sign is okay for the most part and over numbers that are not too huge and in ordinary conditions, then you are in fact somebody who grasps the rule of addition, who understands the plus sign. And the argument, as we've said several times, that Kripke applied was, well, that can't be a matter of having a particular disposition because your disposition includes dispositions to make mistakes and you are finite. But here you are grasping something which doesn't make mistakes, as it were. Your understanding goes beyond your actual practice. That was basically Kripke's refutation of the dispositionalist view at the level of the individual. So it's somewhat ironic that the view comes back at the level of the community, and the same objections apply again. If we say that the community's grasp of a rule, understanding of a symbol, a sign, is a matter of its actual behavior, of its dispositions, we again face those two problems, that it has dispositions to make mistakes and its dispositions are finite. Whereas, depending on what sort of word it is, but many words at any rate have infinitistic applications. There's no limit to the extent that they can be applied. That doesn't apply to all words, of course. It doesn't apply to the word book, for example, because there's only a finite number of books in the universe. But it certainly applies to the concept of number, as we've been saying. Natural number, there are an infinity of natural numbers, and the addition function is infinitistic in the sense that it never grinds to a halt. It always churns out answers to input sums that it's given. And if the argument against a dispositionalist view worked at the level of the individual, then it works at the level of the community, surely. Now, of course, you have to recognize we're going beyond Kripke in the sense that Kripke himself doesn't say, oh, look, my skeptical solution is actually a dispositionalist account. That was my move. He hasn't seen that point, or if he has, he would reject it, I think. But it seems to me that that is indeed what it is. I see no objection to simply identifying Kripke's skeptical solution with a straight solution of a certain sort, namely one which says that the factuality of a meaning ascription consists in matters of agreement and disagreement between the individual and the rest of the community. So if the individual does what the rest of the community does with a particular sign, then it's just a fact that the community and the individual do agree, and the individual counts as a rule follower. That's just a fact. It is a factual matter. And then I said, well, that's in effect to apply the dispositionalist analysis at the level of the community, and that was going beyond anything that Kripke himself says. But if it's correct, then, I think his own objections to that account bite, both at the level of the individual and at the level of the community. So it can't be a correct account of what our understanding consists in. So that suggests that we do need a straight solution. The skeptical solution doesn't seem to work in the sense that it turns into a straight solution of a certain sort to which there are decisive objections, namely the very ones that Kripke himself brought against a certain version of a straight solution, the dispositionalist version. That suggests, therefore, that we need a straight solution, but another sort of straight solution. And, of course, the one that, as I think I indicated earlier, that a lot of people have gone for, if we go back to the various options that Kripke offered us in the case of the individual, if you recall, one of them was that understanding consisted in having a sui generis mental state, a mental state of understanding which can't be reduced to anything else. It doesn't consist in anything else. It is what it is, and it's of its own sort. Well, that's the kind of line that a lot of people have favoured in response to Kripke's skeptical paradox. I mean, Kripke himself, you know, he said, well, that's a mysterious solution. We can't really do anything with it. You know, if we end up having to say that, all right, but that would be a real defeat. That's the kind of line that he took. And in a sense, I think that's right. It's not an illuminating response, obviously, to say, well, we just do grasp these rules. We just do understand the plus sign in the infinitistic way that we do. And it doesn't correlate precisely with our behaviour, because our behaviour is riddled with error and is finite. But nevertheless, we can in thought grasp these infinitistic, these Platonistic objects. And we just do. So, you know, that's my answer to you, skeptic. I just do know. So I know that the answer to this sum is 125 rather than 5, because I've grasped the rule of addition. I know that I have. I remember that that was the rule that I learned, and I hereby now apply it. And there's no account I can give, there's no reductive account, as we said before, of any facts that that consists in. It's its own fact, as it were. It's a primitive, sui generis fact that I did grasp that rule. And I've also been saying, really, that we can apply that kind of response at the level of the community. In effect, I've been applying that response to the skeptic at the level of the community. So one might not want to talk about a sui generis mental state there, because one might not want to say that the whole community enjoys a single mental state, although you could say that. But at any rate, the whole community shares an understanding of the plus sign, which, as I've been saying, goes beyond its own practice, goes beyond its own behaviour, and is ideal, is infinitistic. We're confident that we really do grasp the rule of addition, even though, as we said, that rule outstrips anything in our practice. So again, a skeptic coming along and challenging the whole community, Kripke style, what fact can you point to, you earthlings, which makes you so sure that you really are applying the rule of addition and not some deviant quaddition-like rule that mimics addition up to some very huge number but then departs from it thereafter? Well, there isn't going to be any such fact that we can point to, not the sort of fact that the skeptic wants us to point to, not a different sort of fact that would somehow constitute the first sort of fact and allow us to justify our belief that we are indeed applying that particular rule rather than a deviant rule. There's not going to be anything we can point to in answer to the skeptic. Nevertheless, it seems even more convincing at the level of the community than it was at the level of the individual, I would say, that we are entitled to be confident that that is the rule we are indeed following as a community. It really is the rule of addition and not some deviant quaddition-like rule. that we associate with the cross symbol, the plus sign. So in a way, that's an unsatisfying answer to the skeptic. What you're in effect saying is that meaning, normativity, are not reducible to other terms. And that, I think Kripke is right to say that, you know, that move does leave things mysterious. Nevertheless, it seems to be the right answer. And maybe we should just accept that rather than trying to find some kind of reductive account of meaning and normativity. It may be that normativity in particular, oughtness, is a fundamental status that can't be reduced to other terms.